Okay. David, hey, let's go ahead and get this intro started. You know what? I have been thinking. I have been thinking, David, that our show is not as funny as it used to be. You know what I'm saying?
It used to be funny.
Do you agree?
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
yeah, I don't think our show is as funny as it used to be. I fired up iTunes, listened to some of our early shows from the early era.
Right, right.
And you and I,
like the 1840s.
You and I were like excited. We were funny. We were just, you know, we were snappy. We're just snapping it up. And the jokes were just going back and forth like crazy. Those were the good old days.
Right.
And now you and I sound sad. We sound morose. We sound tired.
Well, yeah.
A little bit bored. David's just agreeing. Yeah, that's pretty much right, Jim. But you know what we're going to do? We are going to, this stops today. This ends today. We are bringing the funny back to flogging.
Make flogging funny again?
Make flogging funny again.
We should make
hats.
We're
going to have, we should, we can make hats, shirts, underwear. We can do it all. what we're going to do is we're going to have our good old close personal mutual friend, Mitch Hedberg. Yes, that's right. Mitch Hedberg. He's going to help us out again. All right. I'm very excited. So if you remember, David, way back in the day,
didn't Saul lose his kingdom for stuff like this?
details. Well, you and I did an intro a long time ago where we just told Mitch Hedberg jokes back and forth in our Mitch Hedberg voices. We tried to do a little bit of an impression of the guy, and I think it was a hit. No one laughed, but you and I were laughing on the inside. Well, we're going to do that again. I, Jim Briggs, looked up some essential Mitch Hedberg jokes, and we're going to tell them to you folks today. We're going to tell Mitch Hedberg jokes to our listenership. So, David, I'm going to give you the option of starting or me starting. Because last time the accusation was thrown at me that your jokes were not funny and mine were.
Oh.
These are randomized.
Okay.
These are randomized. So, if you want to go ahead and
what
start.
What was the algorithm for randomizing them?
I had Mark Zuckerberg do it for me. and now he's everywhere. Let's go ahead and get this thing started. Are you ready?
I am not.
You gonna go first?
I need 2 seconds.
Okay. What are you doing?
Okay. I was listening to Mitch Hedberg. You know how you told me to practice?
Yeah.
I didn't actually do that.
You know the thing you told me to do, Jim? I didn't do that.
I was at work today. Also, I'm not feeling good, so.
What's that like?
I don't know.
Being at work and, you know. Anyways,
I guess I was on the couch with my laptop all day because I'm sick and I still needed to work.
With Sarah sitting over there doing her work from her laptop.
She came and sat with me for a little bit. It was nice.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yes. All right, let's do it. Come on, go ahead. We got to make this thing funny.
What am I supposed to do?
Snap it up.
I had an apartment and I had a neighbor, and whenever he would knock on my wall, I knew he wanted me to turn my music down, and that made me angry because I like loud music. So when he knocked on the wall, I'd mess with his head. I'd say, go around. I cannot open the wall. I don't know if you have a door on your side, but here there's nothing. It's just flat.
Mitch Hedberg, everyone. All right, here's the next one. I hope the next time I move, I get a real easy phone number. Something that's real easy to remember. Something like 222222. I would say, sweet. And then people would say, Mitch, how do I get a hold of you? I'd say, just press 2 for a while. And when I answer, you will know you have pressed 2 enough.
This is what my friend said to me. He said, you know what I like? Mashed potatoes. It's like, dude, you got to give me time to guess. If you're going to quiz me, you must insert a pause there.
Good point. That's fair. Whenever I go to shave, I assume there's someone else on the planet shaving, so I say, I'm gonna go shave too. This next one might be my favorite.
I think Bigfoot is blurry. That's the problem. It's not the photographer's fault. Bigfoot is blurry, and that's extra scary to me. There's a large, out-of-focus monster roaming the countryside. Run! He's fuzzy! Get out of here!
A large, out-of-focus monster... roaming the countryside. Okay. I walked into Target, but I missed.
You keep all getting right. The short ones.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to hang a map of the world in my house. and then I'm going to put pins into all the locations that I've traveled to. But first, I'm going to have to travel to the top two corners of the map so it won't fall down.
One of my favorite things about how he delivers these, and I'm trying to do this, is you feel like there should be another word coming after the punchline. Like, he will just stop the sentence without a period.
I don't think he's a powerful closer, but that's part of his appeal.
Well, yeah, that's why it's so funny. Like,
yeah, it's so good. I'm trying to do better at my Mitch Hedberg impression. I'm gonna try. Here we go. If you're watching a parade, make sure you stand in one spot. Don't follow it. It never changes. And if the parade is boring, run in the opposite direction. You will fast forward the parade. You know, I like that. That's less of a joke and more of like a
just advice,
like a good practical point. All right.
I like an escalator because an escalator can never break. It can only become stairs. You would never see an escalator temporarily out of order sign. Just an escalator temporarily stairs. Sorry for the convenience. We apologize for the fact that you can still get up there.
That's a good point. What am I drinking? NyQuil on the rocks. When you're feeling sick but sociable. Next one's good.
A burrito is a sleeping bag for ground beef.
It is. You wonder if you should laugh at that, but you do, because it's just it's funny. I got a long one here. Here we go. Some people think I am high on stage. I would never get high before a show because when I am high, I don't want to stand in front of a bunch of people I don't know. That does not sound comfortable. Like when you're high and a joke doesn't work, it's extra scary. It's like, whoa, what what happened there? I am retreating within myself. Why have all these people gathered? Why am I elevated? Why am I not facing the same way as everybody else? And what is this electric stick? Okay, I'm sorry. And what is this electric stick in my hand? That would be scary, you know.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Well, you're in Colorado. You're the closest.
No, around here, all we smell is secondhand fertilizer.
Oh, it is. There's some farm country out there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I literally live on a farm, Jim.
Oh, it is. Oh, okay, great. Yeah.
I had a piece.
Sure you...
What?
I was just going to remind you to make sure to milk the cows in the morning.
Did you just ask me if this was a cow?
No, milk the cow tomorrow. Never.
Sorry, it was office reference. Man, I'm not doing so good, Jim. My words
aren't
coming
great.
Out. My face.
It's okay.
As they should.
We're doing fine. We're doing fine.
I had a piece of carefree sugarless gum, and I was still worried. It never kicked in, so I took it back to the store.
That's a good Hedberg joke. I like that. All right, finally, on making flogging funny again, last Mitch Hedberg joke. My belt holds up my pants. And my pants have belt loops that hold up the belt. What is really going on down there? Who is the real hero? Oh, this guy is so good, David. And that concludes our intro for the day of making flogging funny again. I hope the audience laughed as much as we did.
Mm.
But that was good. That was good. It's good to laugh, David. It's good to laugh.
It is.
Yeah. All right. Well, you want to start the show?
What do I do to start the show?
Just
agree?
Submit to me. Submit. Give me your whole heart and submit to me. Can you do this, please?
Jim was actually just saying this to his wife when they were doing family devotions on Ephesians 5.
Please, please just do Philemon with me. No. Submit to me. Give me your heart. Christy, give it to me now. Okay.
And that's the last episode she listened to.
And there we are.
The podcast you are about to hear contains the histrionic and problematic conversations of a stodgy Presbyterian and a casserole-loving Baptist. Their interactions are volatile at times and unpleasant most of the time. In many nations, this is considered a mild form of torture. We strongly advise you to stop this nonsense and go do something useful with your life. Otherwise, if you insist on listening to this mess, welcome to the lightest form of flogging.
Thank you, Deep Voice Man. I also welcome you to the Lightest Form of Flogging podcast, episode 75, David, huh? 75.
Wait,
right there.
What?
Boom. 3/4 of a century.
Is it 65?
No, we're 75, my man. Where have you been the last 10 episodes?
Moving, I guess.
It explains so much.
You're right. Last episode. Wait, did I skip any? No, no. Okay.
No.
Oh, yeah. It's 74. You got it.
Which is 75 in our in the flogging universe.
We have a two indexed.
There's a Marvel universe here. And our universe. We did a way forward machine on one of our episodes. I am your functional and material host, Jim, and sitting halfway across the country from me in a contraction negotiated 1,000 miles is my co-host, David, who, according to listener Dr. David Latchett, is now technically an old Earth creationist. Yeah.
That's in follow-up, Jim.
Yeah, that's in follow-up. Just stay tuned. Hey, show, David. So give us an update. How's Colorado going so far? You're a couple weeks in now, coming acclimated to the, can you stand up quickly from a couch now without passing out?
Or? You know, the altitude's never been the problem, but we are running a humidifier in our basement 24/7. People like,
is it really?
It's no, really
you
dry.
From Spokane. It's dry here.
No, but it's drier it's really here. Dry.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's rough.
It's rough.
So we have it at like a temperature that we consider, or at like a humidity level that we consider slightly below what we would consider comfortable.
Yeah.
And Sarah's mom comes down and is like, it's so moist down here. It's like a cave.
It's a rainforest in here. It's awesome.
Yeah. So
you're just dying over there. Okay. Well, I hope your skin improves to a more supple level than it is now. Church Watch, David McCookie Church Watch.
So yesterday was Monday. The day before that was Sunday.
Okay. This is how David answers my questions.
Sarah and I just forgot what day it is. Sarah and I left at 9 a.m. Uh-huh. We arrived at church, actually like a minute or two late because traffic is confusing. It's also a 50 minute drive to our church that we're now starting to attend regularly. This was our first weekly, our first weekly attendance. So we got there, we had church. It was great. We sang psalms. Yeah. There was a sermon. Scripture was read. Scripture was read again. We sang more psalms. We sang more psalms.
David,
scripture was read again.
Is this a David church? Is this a David church?
This is a David church. This is very much a David church.
Good. Okay, good.
It's a covenanter church, literally. Like it's in their constitution.
So this is
that
real
covenanters.
This is real deal.
This is it.
Because last week you didn't go to.
I went to
church.
A Dutch Reformed congregation that's closer to where we are now.
Why would you go there though? I don't like
the long and short of it is
it was good.
We didn't want to be in a spot where we're having to drive 45 minutes to church if we don't have to. So we wanted to try a few in the area. We're not sure what housing prices will be like in 6 months. So in the event that like they skyrocketed anywhere near where we wanted to be for this church, we just wanted to have, and we wanted to have an idea of the landscape too, for like recommending to friends that we might make. And anyway, this week, so we did that. Then there was Sunday school. Then, the pastor and his wife, and their whole family invite us over for lunch. We hung out there until a class that started at 4 p.m. that I got to attend. There was an evening service at 5:30, and we were literally just doing church things all day, and everything was edifying and wonderful. And like, it was actually really interesting because my like spiritual refreshment meter was like maxed out, and I was just really, really happy. But then the next day I realized that my introvert battery was at 1%. So we're going to have to find some kind of a balance here, because I was just like, both Sarah and I were just like,
yeah, you know, just like you have to acclimate to the altitude. You may have to acclimate to the spiritual high, David. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Getting that on fire feeling is exhausting, isn't it?
Yes.
I forget. David is now covenanter, so I got to be careful what I say to him.
I do. No, they did give me a broadsword and a copy of the Westminster Standards. So.
As is proper for someone in that neck of the woods. Well, great. I'm happy. Yeah. I'm glad things are kind of coming together. You found your people and you're coming home, David. You're coming home. Okay. Well, a couple of housekeeping things, if you're okay with that.
Absolutely. Why was that not follow up?
What do you mean?
Well, we just talked about.
Granted,
I will give you that our follow up is a record 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 lines.
Right. it's not technically something we talked about, you know, formally during last show. It's just an informal update on the church thing. So I didn't put it in follow-up. I did it before. So you're just going to have to deal with that, my brother. Okay, David, a couple of things before we get into follow-up. I'll be brief. Hey, folks, just a reminder, a couple of reminders for you today, actually. If you want to be on the show, you can call the show. Just dial 707-998-8547 or 707-99-TULIP and leave a voicemail. Yes, you can. You can call in with your favorite Mitch Hedberg joke or any joke for that matter. But as long as you give us your heart, your hopes, and your dreams, well, that's good enough for me. Call us, won't you? We are ready to believe you. David, hey, listeners of The Lightest Form of Flogging like to congregate online. And if any of our listeners who are not on our Slack channel would like to join it, how might they do it?
That's a very good question, Jim. I think the best way for them to do that would be to hop onto their web browser, whether that's Safari or Google Chrome or Firefox or Edge.
Internet Explorer.
But where they like need to go.
I like how you faltered when you said that. Like you almost wanted to Internet Explorer.
It's actually not something that like you can get to easily anymore. Microsoft completely dropped support for it. I actually just had to set it up for work because I needed to test it because a client is somehow using it.
And you were laughing the whole time.
Yeah, I set up a whole air-gapped VM so that I didn't risk like, because as soon as you launch it, it's like 1,000 viruses.
Right, I totally know what you're talking about.
1,000 generations of viruses live in you now.
So Slack channel, how do our listeners join the fun on Slack?
Anyway, you're going to take that browser that hopefully is not Internet Explorer, and you are going to go to https://slack.techreformation.com. There you will enter your email address and a password, and you will be sent a link to join our Slack. Mm. Within our Slack, there is a channel, as you would say, Jim, called Flogging, and that is where our listeners have decided to form a sort of non-ecclesiological ecclesia to discuss the show.
A collective, if you will. And boy, howdy, did we get them excited from the topic of our last show.
Now, don't talk about collective. Sarah and I are watching Star Trek.
Okay, sorry. But yeah, they go on to the Slack and complain about you and I. It's just a wonderful place to be.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of complaining. That's why we have, that accounts for a third of our follow-up.
Oh yes. We have a lot of follow-up today. So with that being said, one more piece of housekeeping for you friends before we move on. Folks, if you spend your days talking to your iPhone, but not to Siri and any actual person, just your actual phone, and you are an iTunes user, you are the perfect candidate to write us an iTunes review. Please take some time away from cleaning your Apple card and drop a 5-star review on our iTunes show page. You will get gratitude from me, emotional distance but appreciation from David, but best of all, you will be helping the show. Write us a 5-star review on iTunes. Do it today. David, we have follow-up to get to, and we must
We should probably alternate these.
Yes. You want to alternate?
Well, I mean, you only have like two things, but I feel like if we space them out a little, it'll help.
A little help?
You see? I told you. I don't feel good, Jim.
I don't feel good, Jim. What do you want from me? Come on. Okay. Well, what was that?
That was my fake sniffling sound.
Stop it. That's awful. That is awful, sir.
Thank you.
First item of follow-up, Ben Robin, our beloved listener and guide of the flogging show, let me know that I screwed up my follow-up from last week from something he sent on our Slack channel regards to a guy named what I called him Herculitis, which is clearly not spelled that way, but that's what I said.
Isn't it Herculesis? Herculius.
It sounds better, but Ben reminded me in our Slack channel that it is pronounced Heraclitus. Heraclitus. Do I have that right?
Heraclitus.
Heraclitus. So Heraclitus's dream is what Ben wanted me to know about, learn about. And now that I have Heraclitus's name right, I could not care less.
First up, I don't think I need to mention this one. It was just that there were problems with my mixer. I was cutting in and out. You probably heard me sustain what Jim calls B flat earlier. This week, everything seems to be better. And the moral of the story is do not, under any circumstances, plug your USB mixer or otherwise audio device into a hub. Plug it directly into your computer.
Okay.
Only directly into your computer. Jim, I'm looking at you.
Okay. All right. All right. I gotcha. My mic today is USB'd right directly into my computer, as is my webcam.
All right.
As is my umbilical cord. Now, that's good to know. That's good to know for anyone who wishes to voluntarily edit the show, because last week was a nightmare.
I do apologize, Jim.
Ooh, I edited out a lot of your cutouts, so right. The audience didn't hear as much of those, but that's good. Okay.
David, actually, that leads into the one before RPW Watch, if you want to do that one first.
So folks, here's the thing you have to know. Last week, I deleted the second intro in a row. So we had two shows whose intro segments I deleted.
In their entirety.
In their entirety. Because, well, for a couple of reasons. Last week was a long episode and I needed to cut it for time. But two, it absolutely wasn't funny because David attempted to play the game Would You Rather with me again. We all know how the first time went around. Like, David gave me two options, and I just picked one and said, so I'll just do this one. Anything else you need? So David attempted a second Would You Rather game with me. And it was, I asked like a question or two, and then I just clearly chose one again. You had a lot of patience with me, but I clearly don't know how to play that game.
I know. So, I'm going to send you an episode.
Please do.
And the timestamp for you to listen.
Talking about the podcast. The Reform Pod,
yeah. The Reform Podcast, okay. Yeah.
Well, I will listen and we will try one more time to play Would You Rather, and I hope that I will get it right.
All right. But we'll do that next week, Jim. You got to be ready.
Okay, next week, we'll do it.
I was wrong about the days. I know if you were listening last week and I kept saying things like, oh, on the first or the second day, God divided the waters and from the dry land and all of that. I just kept getting the timeline wrong within Genesis.
You were doing that from memory, basically, right?
Yeah, and the reason for that was primarily, well, and even I was even inconsistent with my own memory. But the reason for that was because I knew that I was having audio issues, and so I was trying to use my computer as little as possible, so I couldn't pull up the passage and have it in front of me, which you should always do in situations like this.
I would have benefited from having Genesis open as well, but neither you or I did it, and probably should have.
Well, this is not a theology show. It's literally two morons talking.
No, and I was not hoping to talk about what we talked about last week. I was hoping to talk about something else, but you had different plans, didn't you, David? You wanted to fight
me. Well, don't worry. We'll talk about it again this week.
Oh, good. hey, David, I have an update for you.
And finally, you get to this. Yes.
RPW Watch update. Yes, very exciting. I committed, you told me, basically that since I watched Spirit and Truth documentary, that you wanted periodic updates when
I said that you should feel free to share them. Yes.
Yeah. Feel free to share when I made a leap ahead in time, in progression, in sanctification towards this goal of holding to the regulative
principle. One small step for Jim, one giant leap for new Calvinist kind.
I have a card. They sent me in the mail. So I have an update for you today. So I'm gonna be as brief as I can on this, because we have we don't have a lot of time today.
Right.
We don't have a lot of time. But you'll be proud of me. I vehemently argued against prayer walking the other day. Are you familiar with the concept of prayer walking, David?
Is that where you walk and pray at the same time?
No, it is not.
There
is walking, there is praying, and you can pray while you walk, but there's prayer walking.
Ah.
It's kind of a charismatic-ish thing.
Right.
It's used in evangelism. It's where you are to purposefully go out into a neighborhood or some sort of geographic location and pray as you walk, and what you see dictates what you pray. So it's like an evangelistic tool. You do it before you evangelize. Or if there's like a neighborhood you want to go evangelize, you have to prayer walk it in order to prime it. You know, get it ready, prime it.
Right, right. Like putting A1 on the steak.
That's right. And I'm going to be as vague as possible here so I don't get myself into trouble.
Right.
I'm not going to say where I did this or with whom I did this with. But the John Knox in me.
With whom I did this with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The John Knox in me. Came out, I stuck my neck out and I put my foot down and argued against this extra biblical concept like you would not believe. And the language that I was using sounded like I was arguing from the stance of the regulative principle of worship. I mean, not worship, but the regulative principle. Whereas, like, you know, if you advocate and impress upon another Christian to do a certain ritual or thing that is not commanded in the Bible, I said that was pure legalism. And you are wrong to bind the conscience of another believer by asking him or telling him that he should do, or he or she should do this thing that is not found in the Bible. And one of the reasons why I said that was prayer walking is essentially saying that prayer is inadequate. You have to add innovation to it in order for it to become more efficacious. And I fought, and I was proud of myself, and people gave me weird looks while I was doing it. So that's how I know I was right. So I thought, I have to tell David this because my metamorphosis is ongoing. I'm changing into the fly as time goes on. And I felt really great. I mean, like the power surging through my veins.
Right.
I've never felt more powerful, David.
And now you're wearing a kilt, right?
I am wearing a kilt, nothing else on it and under it. And I won't show you. I won't verify that. But you'd be proud of me, David.
I am proud of you.
I argued against an extra biblical concept, and I sounded just like a guy who believes in the regulative principle of worship.
And not that you believe in it. You sounded like a guy who believes in it.
I sounded like, yeah. I mean,
he's at least adjacent to somebody who believes in the regulative principle.
But I'm getting closer. So there you go. That's mine. That's the end of my follow up. Let's go with the rest of yours.
All right. Well, that was a cool story, Jim. I liked it.
Right on.
Why did that sound so... I'm not trying to sound condescending. But I feel like what I just said sounded condescending. Do you ever get into a state where like you can't stop sounding condescending or sarcastic?
Yeah. I mean, it happens. I'm usually feeling it though. I mean, doing it on purpose. No.
I mean, you're trying to clarify something and make somebody not feel awkward, and everything you say could be interpreted as you're being sarcastic at them. And you're just like trying desperately to find something that you can say that can't be interpreted that way.
Well, David, you're overthinking. I did not take that comment as you claimed, but now I'm starting to wonder. Now I'm suspicious. Now I don't like you.
Okay, so next up,
you did this.
I just have a point here that says Jim is not 6 day. You call yourself 6 day, but everybody else who says I'm 6 day believes that the material substance was created in 6 days. You can say I'm 6 day functional, or like, but you need to modify that terminology, because I think that was the thing that was throwing me off the whole time, and why at every point you're like, oh no, there can be animals, and I was like, what do you mean there can be animals? And you're like, oh no, there can be humans. I'm like, what do you mean there can be humans? Because I was thinking you had set yourself up as something, and I interpreted it the way that I'd heard that term used before.
We can at least say that I'm not a literal 6 day guy like you are. Or like others are, who take that phrase and put it as a label on themselves. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I can get a little squirrely and nuanced on you, and I will also say this, that people who believe in that cosmic temple framework view, I would say the vast majority of them aren't literal 6 day guys, and we all know this,
right?
We all get it. But if you argue with the presuppositions of that viewpoint, of that framework, then the functionalizing could have taken 6 days, you know, that it could have been an actual event.
Right. So you would be a 6 day functionalist.
Stop it. My whole point is not to take I just hit my mic stand, is not to take Genesis 1 and just be so afraid of it that I have to say it's all poetic, or it's all just there to show everybody else in the ancient Near East that the Hebrew God is one. And he created simply with his own voice. You know, it's just, that's all it's there for.
Right.
And we don't need to get it. And I don't like that. I mean, I sympathize with some of those viewpoints, and I think they're compelling in some ways. But I did not want to jettison Genesis 1. I wanted to have the words on the page mean something. And this view does allow, I think it does. I might be wrong. But it does allow for an event that could take 6 days. The functionalizing, you know,
right.
But I'm going to cede to you here and give you that point. I can't say that I am. So
yeah,
I don't think I will say that until unless I change.
But yeah, you're right. And this wasn't me trying to like pick a fight with you, but I do think if you're talking to people about this and you start off with, I'm a 6 day creationist, and then Later, we find out that you believe everything was created over millions of years and you're a 6-day function thing happened. I think it's setting us up, because I would listen to last episode and there was just a lot you missing me and me missing you.
This is starting to happen, but I can say that if creation has a functional component to it, I can still use the word created.
Right, but you mean created differently than everybody you're talking to.
Right, yeah, and I get that. So I don't want to cause confusion.
Right, yeah, and that's all I'm saying.
One of the values of that show last week was, you know, I didn't relish in arguing about it. I wasn't planning on talking about it in the way that we did, but it's good to get that stuff out so that you can kind of open yourself up to the arrows that can come at you and you can take them and break them off and keep fighting. But, you know, it's good for me to receive clarification and to try and to sort these things out in my head, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there you go. So thank you for the iron that sharpens iron, David.
Next up, I have just a question for you. I'm not going to respond to your answer, but I was listening and I knew that at some point
Why would you not respond?
Well, just because I don't want to get too far into this.
You have never. Okay, all right.
That's. I'm literally like putting this constraint on myself because we could turn this into another episode. That's like last week's episode. But last week, I felt like you had something against the. I felt like you had something against the appearance of age view. That there was something wrong with it, and I kept asking in different ways to try to get you to elaborate on that. And I never felt like I had a satisfactory answer. Well, listening to the episode, I realized you literally said that the answer. Well, God made it that way. Is a quote cheap and worthless retort.
I said that.
You did say which that. Is my view, by the way. I would like to understand just, and maybe you feel like you exaggerated or whatever. That's fine. I'm not looking for like an apology or anything. Even though that's the meanest thing you've ever said about a view that I hold. I'm just looking for you to explain maybe a little bit of why you find God just made it that way to be cheap and worthless or a less than good answer.
Let me have a, I thank you, David. I thank you for giving me this chance to clarify I feel like saying this in Bill Hazinger's voice. Thank you, David, for giving me a chance to clarify this view that I have put forth. I don't know why I said that. I just heard Bill Hazinger saying that in my head.
Actually, whenever I'm about to say something, I ask myself, would Bill Hazinger say it? And if he would, I do not say that thing.
I do not say that thing. Thank you. I was just about to finish it for you. The cheap and the worthlessness is not about the view. I think it's about more of the retort. It's how it's used. You know how online when you're arguing with somebody and they just refuse to address your argument and they just kind of keep sidestepping around it and
tiptoeing
around the tulips, something like that. And it's frustrating to kind of argue with somebody about that, because you just want them to just deal with the argument that you're putting forth, because that's what you're there for. And it's just wasting time for them to keep dodging it. When someone says God just made it that way, it is oftentimes, in my experience, used to shut down the argument. It is, in a sense, not dealing with the arguments of the person that you are saying that to. It is not. It is just a way to sidestep and to deflect and to not deal with the issue. If you have such a problem with the way scientists measure how far back an event was, I think it's best to deal with their arguments and their methods of measurement rather than just saying, "Well, God just made it that way," because it's like a cheap attempt to deal with their arguments. This issue. What happened in Genesis 1 and the material world are aligned, in my view. And I think that retort refuses to align them. It just says, no. You're putting fingers into your ears. You're closing your eyes. You're saying, la, 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 la. That retort reminds me of that. And that's why I said that. So it's more about how it's used, not the view itself. So I hope that clarifies things a little bit. I have great respect for the view. I held it. How it's used is my problem. So here I stand. I can do no other. You can respond, David, please. I mean, does that at least clarify?
I can see.
I wasn't careful with my words at first.
I can see how like just using it as a retort and not even hearing the other side out would be worthless.
With their arguments
in some sense,
having a response to their arguments.
Right.
Like, okay, let's deal with those methods. you know.
But at the same time, carbon dating. At the same time, like the interesting thing about the argument, like it is functionally a trump card. It's one of those things where you get to say it because like you get to say it. Like if it is true, then it's true and you don't need to go any further, right? Like if it is true that God made the stars,
you can go further though. You can.
Yeah.
Because truth is truth. You know, you can go for, it's not a mystery.
But that's what I mean is like, if a scientist comes to me and says it takes a billion years for a star to form, how did the sun come into existence instantly? Like I have the same response that I have when somebody says, if a guy is dead for 3 days, he can't come back to life. Like, it's functionally the same response is like, yes, that's normally how long it takes. And in eternity, I look forward to watching stars form over billions of years. I imagine that could be a fun pastime. It could be fun to watch climates form and like all these things happen naturally and see if they happen exactly as scientists say they will, or if there's variances, or if they're wildly off, because again, they've never actually seen it. They're kind of taking educated guesses. But regardless, like what we have here, you know, when I look around, if it is the case that God just made things already ready to go and didn't take millions of years to do them, that's just as much a miracle as God raising somebody from the grave or turning water to wine or what have you. And and at the end of the day, if it was a miraculous creation, then that's what it was. And like, it's interesting to hear how scientists think these things happen. But from the Bible, I would say that, well, that may be how it normally happens. But once God made a whole bunch of stuff all at once in 6 days.
Okay. Then what you just did is rarely accompanied by, well, God just made it that way.
I gotcha.
When that retort happens, not a lot is said and not a lot is used to deal with the other person's position.
But that is the substance of the argument that I'm making, is God did make it that way. Like he made it all at once, even though that's not how it normally happens.
Okay. Then I retract my cheap and worthlessness retort of that retort and move on to, okay.
All right. Just so you know, I'm not easily offended. If I had a position that you thought was cheap and worthless, like you can say that to me.
Well, I don't, you get fired up though sometimes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I get fired up, but that's different from being offended.
Okay. Well, all right. Good point. Fair. That's fair.
Maybe it's getting defensive about the position, but it's different from like, oh, I'm not going to talk to Jim again because he said something mean to me.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay. Let's get into some of this Slack follow-up. Evidently, according to listener David Latchett, the Earth passed being 6,000 years old in 1998 or maybe good six call. Or maybe five. And so I guess that means I'm technically an old Earth guy.
Yeah. Welcome to the club, man. Do you want a jacket or...
And then there's a point in here that I'll let you address, Jim. It's about Usher and I think Eminem.
Usher and Eminem. I couldn't figure out the name of the guy who counted back, famously so. His name was Bishop Usher. Beloved listener, Dr. David Latchett pointed that out. It was Bishop Usher who did that. He was not the only one who counted, in a sense, and he certainly was not the one who invented young Earth creationism. Of course, he just counted back and that was the number he came up with. And we have passed that point. So we have to say 6,020 or 25. So yeah, Bishop Usher. Okay.
And then David Latchett wanted to know how Jim sleeps at night.
I sleep on my side, two pillows, three blankets.
Huh. Three blankets.
Yeah. Outside too.
Keep the room cold.
No, they're thin.
Oh, okay. I wish I could
wait.
Keep...
I like weight. Weight is more important than warmth.
Okay. Good to know. It takes 8 minutes for light to travel from the sun to our
indeed
blue sparkly planet.
So David, we were talking
about weeks and months.
if the sun exploded, what would you do with your 8 minutes?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I think I'd probably recant of Christianity. But it's not like I would have a way to know. Like the fastest thing is light, and like it, as soon as we see it, we would be dead. Actually, that's another interesting question: is like, would the explosion, like, would the effects of the explosion take 8 minutes, or would they take longer? Like, the effects of the explosion would travel, like the shockwave would take way longer anyway. This is stupid, and there's not a shockwave because it's space. I don't understand anything now.
Oh, okay. Moving on. What's our next
point? Arthur Fonzarelli.
I don't know why that says Fonzarellit. I thought it was Fonzarelli. Hold on.
Who did you say his name was? I don't remember.
I think it was Mark or... Mark Fonzie.
Chad
John Fonzie. John Fonzie.
You know that guy?
John Fonzie.
Chad Fonzarelli from Happy Days. Mike Fonzarelli.
I never responded to that. Here we go. Arthur Fonzarelli, yes.
All right.
And then I have one last thing, and I just wanted to point out our show has no real function, and thus, from a ancient Near East perspective, does not exist.
Thank you for finally coming along with me. All right, that does it for follow-up. That was epic.
That was.
A while. Yeah. I was wondering if today's show should just be...
It would be really fun to get to that point. I mean, we could dive in further on the creation stuff.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it really depends on the episode.
As long as that was, I had like five or six things where I just wanted to like argue with you about the creationism thing.
Oh, good. Yeah.
But I refrained.
To keep me sharp. Well, we'll save it for another time, David, because today we have to focus on the funny. And there's nothing funnier than evangel shaming. So we're going to take a quick music break. And then when we come back, we're going to discuss very briefly a topic today. And I look forward to doing it.
Mm.
When the when that main topic becomes functional, then we'll come back. See you then.
Some very enjoyable music. And now we're going to talk about our main topic, which, as Jim already said, is evangel shaming, a word that I made up and that Jim Googled and found nothing for.
I'm proud of you.
I know.
That's awesome.
In today's day
and
age.
How often does that happen?
Yeah, it's tough.
It just doesn't happen that much.
This is a topic that I wrote literally this word, evangel shaming, in our topics list, and then didn't write anything else about it. And it might it might be like 2 years from now or two years ago.
You showed me a tweet.
Really?
Yeah, you did. It was, I don't know who it was or when he said it, but he essentially evangel shamed on Twitter.
Oh.
And you showed me this. And I think you wrote evangel shame.
I should have put it in the show docs. In the doc.
So yeah, you invented a new term, evangel shaming. I don't think it seems like a word that would have been coined by now because it's so easy.
Right.
But nevertheless, ouch. I don't think anyone has. You have, because you are an originator of thought, David.
That is a thing.
So what is evangel shaming?
So before I get into what evangel shaming is, I wanted to say that I don't remember what I meant precisely by this when I listed it as a topic. Jim seems to actually have better memory of what I was talking about in terms of the tweet that I linked to than I did. But this has got me thinking about the... potentially even doing a series because we are running out of good topic ideas, potentially even doing a series on like how people persuade people of things.
Yeah.
So things like logical fallacies, because evangel shaming, I think, is a sort of red herring, and a sort of appeal to emotion. I think it would be interesting for us to start to like come up with a list of methods that are not, good methods. That people use to convince people of things and think back through our lives and try to remember when we've accepted those arguments and how we came out of them. Yeah. Not even just in theology, but in life in general.
Yeah. Forthcoming. A good series. Forthcoming.
So we're kicking things off with evangel shaming. And at its root, the idea here is that there's a thing in scripture, in this case, it's evangelism, but there's a thing in scripture that there's some indication that we're supposed to do, but the scriptures are relatively vague, not very specific on how and how much we are to do that thing.
I agree with you on this one. You and I are aligned.
So the biblical data on evangelism are basically thus. The Great Commission was given to men who... when the Great Commission was given to the apostles, in the same breath, those same men were also commanded to baptize. And so what that means at the very least is that people in the church carry out different parts of the Great Commission differently at different times. So the command is not to every person to spend 100% of their time, like vocationally, sharing the gospel. You could try to read it that way, but you end up with
everybody being able to baptize if you do, or having to do some exegetical gymnastics.
Yeah, it has been read that way.
Oh, yeah.
It has been interpreted.
Yeah, by Anabaptists.
I'll give you an example. In my Southern Baptist days, we had what were called go trips. And these were short-term mission trips that I don't think you were, well, I don't know. I was an outsider who came in and then left shortly thereafter. So I'm horribly credentialed to talk about this, but it was very much expected that you as a Baptist youth should go on a go trip so that you can, you know, fulfill this evangelistic requirement. And the word go was from the Great Commission, therefore go. So that's why they're called go trips. And if you didn't do these trips, then, well, you were harming the Great Commission. But it's derived from the Great Commission. When anyone thinks about any evangelistic duty, they are thinking about usually the Great Commission. It's cited when we talk about evangelism. Everything points back to the Great Commission. Mm-hmm. And that almost is a topic in and of itself.
That's a good point, yeah.
Commands to apostles versus other people, and how do we interpret those? That's maybe another kettle of fish that we can worry about some other day, since we're running out of topic ideas, David. Which I don't think is true. We're just not looking hard enough.
That's true. Well, that's what I mean. It's like we used to have a big list of them, and it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Now we actually have to go fishing in kettles. Next up here is that there are just very few imperatives around sharing the gospel. If you try to do the like, you know, take a drink every time that the Bible says commands people to share the gospel, you probably won't get drunk.
Lightly buzzed, maybe.
Lightly buzzed, yeah.
Buzzing. A moderate buzzing.
The only example we have of a layperson sharing the gospel is the man born blind, and literally all he does is say, look, I don't know. Go talk to Jesus. He made me see.
That's how I do it.
Clark points that out.
What do you want from me?
Paul doesn't seem to talk about the command to evangelize at all. Like in his epistles, you can't find Paul saying, now you guys, you need to love your neighbor and let him who steals steal no more, and everybody evangelize. Like he does, like that's always omitted. He doesn't seem to do that except in the pastoral epistles. There is the command to all people in one of the Peters. I think it's 1 Peter 3. But there is the command to always be ready to give a defense or an apologia to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's within you, which I would see as sharing the gospel.
Okay.
And I do think that an argument can be made sort of from good and necessary consequence that like you should share the gospel when you have opportunity, because that just seems to be bound up in love for neighbor. If you owe it to your neighbor to, like, he's falling off of the boat and you can grab him and keep him from falling off of the boat and drowning, mm-hmm. like, shouldn't you even more, if you have opportunity to save his soul from hell by presenting the gospel, shouldn't you do that? Of course, right? But basically, there are arguments to be made that Christians have obligation to share the gospel when they have opportunity. And where people frequently start to like really ramp this up is outside of just having opportunity, you need to put yourself in situations or like create opportunities. You need to like actively pursue strangers. And so I grew up in a church where doing things like knocking on people's doors, hosting gospel sharing events, inviting strangers to church, handing out tracts and everything, were expected of congregants. That was
expected of congregants. Now, I think it's safe to say that a lot of pastors would want their congregants to, you know, have to do some sort of evangelistic activity according to their gifts, maybe. But you say, what do you mean by like expected of congregants? Because that's like that's a very peculiar way of saying it.
Yeah,
what does that mean? Like how would that be?
This is kind of
how would you be pursued?
This is kind of the interesting thing about this idea of evangel shaming, because it simply is the case that depending on your line of work, depending on how many coworkers you have, depending on the things that you do, like let's say that you're a garbage collector and you happen to work with some, like the guy that you work with in the truck, it happens to be a Christian as well. That's 40 hours a week where you're not interacting, because you know, as a garbage collector, you don't really interact with people. You get in your truck, you go out, you collect. I actually don't know this. A friend of a friend collects garbage. I don't know if I could ask him though.
Maybe he knocks on doors, David. You never know.
But you hear what I'm saying though. You hear what I'm saying though. Like depending on your calling, depending on what you're doing, like it may not be the case that you can share the gospel every week or every day. Nevertheless, all the time, in the church where I grew up in, there was occasionally sermons where the pastor would ask, okay, hands up if you've shared the gospel within the last year. Hands up if you've shared the gospel within the last 6 months. How about the last month? How about the last week? And literally the point of it, I mean, there'd always be that one person who like happened to have shared the gospel in the last week. But the point of it was to make everybody feel bad, because then they would go on to talk about how can you go to the grocery store and see all the people there and not think about how they're going to hell? How can you love your non-Christian friends if you haven't shared the gospel? Your neighbor could die in a car crash tomorrow, et cetera.
It's directing the answer, isn't it? Questions like that. I mean, you are painted a villain if you answer a certain way, and you're the hero if you answer the other way.
Right, right. And yet,
it's a stark way of doing it.
And yet, that doesn't seem like I would want to argue that like you find more commands in the Bible to tithe and to give to the church than you do to evangelize.
Let me ask you a question. You've brought that up, that issue of frequency. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then, does that mean that we should be tithing more than evangelizing, or thinking about tithing more than we think about evangelizing? To what degree is frequency like an indicator of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think frequency of occurrence in the scripture should do something to indicate how often we should talk about it in our sermons. If we want to preach the whole counsel of God's word, then we need to reflect, to some degree anyway, how frequently the scriptures speak about things.
But all you really need is one command to do something.
No, you're absolutely right. You are absolutely right.
You don't need three or four to make sure. Okay, well, I see this command three or four times, so now I'm gonna think about doing. All you really need is one.
Right. But if you make that, if you have one command for something and you make that like the central point of the Christian life, and it comes up almost every sermon, and that's all that you talk about, you've done something to the balance of what the scriptures think is important. You've tilted the balance.
With that said, then I do agree. I think you are misaligning your congregation with the Bible for sure, because this is about preaching the whole counsel of God. Okay, yeah, and this makes sense. I think we've all heard of churches or have been a part of a church that has evangel-shamed you in some way. I have not heard it to this extent, David, so this is quite an example. I mean, I was thinking back to the churches I've been a part of. I don't think this has happened to me in any of them.
Well, and what's funny is like most of the people in my church did not share the gospel very much. Like, when he got to within the last month, 80 to 95% of the congregation's hands would go down.
Oh, so, okay. This is interesting then. I thought perhaps like these tactics, this is evangel shaming, might have like worked.
And no, that's did it out of
okay. All right. So, all right. Well, he tried his darndest, but the congregation just
yeah.
So a lot of hands went up, like when he talked about like the year.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
All right. Well then, there you go. This to me, I have a slightly different take on it, but very similar to you. It seems that in evangelical culture, the churches that do something like this that would be prone to evangel shaming kind of expect the average Christian to be a Whitfield. They just want a large collection of Whitfields.
Title.
And if you are not, striving to this identity, then you are doing something wrong. And then you should be shamed, and usually are shamed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Versus you should evangelize according to your capacity. In connection to your church. Your church as a whole has a collection of people with various giftings that as a together can fulfill this goal of evangelizing. I think we're living in the former rather than the latter. I think the latter is, I don't see it a lot. And I think that's the biblical view. But I think we're expected to be Whitfields. And when we don't, and when we're not Whitfield, we feel bad about it. Because evangel shame, if it works, I imagine at the time this had an effect on you where you did feel bad that you were not out there, you know, and that's different now, but how did it make you feel back then? I mean, how did it change you?
Yeah, I guess it was, it was hard. I mean, when I was a kid and like couldn't drive, that kind of thing, like it was kind of one of those questions of like, well, what am I supposed to do? Like my situation is I'm homeschooled. Yeah. My parents don't really let me go outside while I'm supposed to be doing schoolwork. I can't evangelize my brother or my mom or my dad.
Well, you can certainly try.
Yeah, you can try. I'm a Baptist. Nobody's really in the New Covenant. So it just, yeah, I mean, it led to me just feeling bad, feeling like I wasn't a mature Christian. And it was something that I would tend to just put out of my head. And this is an interesting side effect, I think, is when you raise the standard for piety to an impossible level, like when you talk about things like, oh, well, like the really mature Christians, they read their Bible for 2 or 3 hours a day. When you do that and you give people the impression that these demands exist, you set them up to violate their conscience regularly. You set them up to build the habit of feeling bad about something and choosing not to think about it anymore. And you help them get better at sinning and ignoring it because they build up this pattern.
Yeah.
So like when I think about it, cause that's what would happen is like the sermon would happen. I would feel really bad. After the sermon, I might think about evangelism. And then I would realize, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know how I'm supposed to do this. I don't have non-Christian friends. I don't have the opportunity to have non-Christian friends, really. Like, what am I supposed to do? I guess I'll just keep sinning. Like, I guess that's just the way this is going to be. And I'm not going to think about it. And I'll maybe pray I'm sorry from time to time.
Let's say you responded differently and you did, you know, just completely change your circumstances. Like, this is impossible, but like you just completely changed your circumstances, changed your life, completely reversed. And you were out there and you were just, you know, you had you're on a horseback and roaming the eastern countryside, like John Wesley evangelizing the tribes.
Right.
Would you then be like, as a result of evangel shaming, could you be doing it with the right motives? Like, it seems to me this tactic, like, I haven't seen it really work. Mm-hmm. Let's say that it does. And you do get more numbers. You get your congregants out there more. Are you happy with now their motivation? Is it possibly tainted that they're doing it out of obligation rather than out of joy or conviction? You know, it just seems that this evangel shaming and other shaming activities like it are really fear-based. They want to create fear so that you can oblige based out of fear, because you don't want to be the guy who raises his hand. Yeah, I haven't shared the gospel in 3 years. Versus the guy who says, yeah, I did it 4 times just, you know, this morning on my way to work. Everyone wants to be that guy. They don't want to be the guy who hasn't done it in a year. Mm-hmm. So you are tempted to, you know, to be George Whitfield. I just don't know if you're doing it for the right reasons. That's just a point I wanted to make on this shaming thing that I've been thinking about. Because I've seen, I mean, while I haven't really been strictly shamed in this way, I saw it on Twitter a ton. That's like evangel shaming central to me. Because it's a place where you're encouraged to be snarky anyway. You get one shot, you get a one-liner, and it feels really good to make fun of it, to make people feel bad on Twitter. So I saw a ton of evangel shaming on Twitter. I'm just like, how do you expect this to work? In what world does this work for you? Are there other ways to inspire people, to equip them for ministry? I think there are.
Yeah.
It's just evangel shaming. Now, I'm done with my soapbox. I'm aware I kind of went a little far with that, but sorry.
But motivation is kind of that's the fundamental thing here, is like, why are people wanting to do this? And like, I think fear and obligation are legitimate reasons for obedience. Like, I don't think they should be your only motivations for obedience. I think that can be evidence of an unregenerate heart. But I think
not a holy fear of God, worldly fear.
Like, right.
I'm scared to be exposed.
Or I'm scared to have to raise my hand. I'm scared of what my fellow Christians will think of me.
This is fear of man.
And that's kind of the point, though, is like, and this is why I have just loved Reformed theology, because there's this objective side to it. There is this like, we must do these things because God commanded it, and we must not do things for any reason. Out of a sense of moral obligation, unless God commanded it. Even in the church that I visited 2 weeks ago, the Dutch Reformed congregation that we visited, the pastor was.
Did they ask you who here is it?
No, the pastor was talking about elders, and he was saying, if I or one of the elders gives you a command and tells you do this, and it's in the scriptures, it's as though Christ himself said that to you, because we are his deputies, his ambassadors. However, if we command you to do something and it's not in the scripture, you're not obligated to do it. And you're actually obligated to not do that thing. You actually owe it to Christ to stick it to me. He didn't say that.
It is tyrannical, David. And to reject tyranny is obedience to God.
But especially in the church, especially when Jesus famously wouldn't even wash his hands before eating to oblige to make the Pharisees happy. Which I don't know, Jim. I think about doing that. Like I think about going to a service where something like that is happening, whether it's washing of hands or lighting of candles, and refusing. And when people ask me, literally just responding with what Jesus says, you know, rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites.
Wow.
Like
can I be there when you do it?
It's just such an interesting thing to me that like, that's not considered acceptable in our, like evangel shaming, making somebody raise their hand to say whether they've done something in the last time period that the Bible doesn't say anything about, that's acceptable. But literally quoting Jesus in an identical situation is not acceptable.
Well, I mean, they don't hear it that much, so they're probably not expecting it. We abhor what we don't expect, David. But yeah, you're right. But
yeah, the motivations thing, like the idea of this idea that like there's like three stacks or three levels in this stack of extra biblical motivation. First of all, there's no obligation to share the gospel with any particular kind of regularity. You know, if you've been like, I mean, some people, I think of friends of mine who are taking care of aging parents, and they just can't get out of the house very much because they literally, if they do, their loved ones will die. Like, what are they going to do? Bring somebody over to monitor their aging? Like, no, there are seasons of life where you're just not going to have opportunity, and that's okay,
right?
Because the scriptures don't prescribe frequency.
Yeah, there are not a lot of metrics in the Bible when it comes to what one should expect when one does evangelize.
Right.
But our current climate is very much metrics based.
Right.
And results are required. Benchmarks are needed. And while, I mean, it might be true for some versus others, but if you do not meet certain metrics, you are, in a sense, shamed. Mm-hmm. And that's not the model we find in Scripture. And it's no surprise to me that once metrics are involved, that's when problems happen.
Mm.
But, you know, I digress. Okay.
Well, but I mean, Scripture does give us metrics for some things, right? Like you're supposed to go to church every week. Like
there's a metric like that you have to be held to.
Right. And you should be shamed.
Do not despise.
Yeah. You should be shamed in some sense. Like you should feel a sense of shame if you are not doing the things regularly that the Bible commands you to do regularly.
And our culture does not appreciate that, does it? And see, we should probably someday talk about the reverse, not the reverse, but the other side of the coin, when you can be shamed. And I do think there are some things, and how do you do it? Because we're just so independent-minded in this country. We're just so independent-minded that whenever we see that happen, we just naturally have this instinct to, you know, turn away in revulsion. Mm-hmm. But that's another problem. But yeah,
it is such an interesting zeitgeist when you think about it, because I think most people who are not, most people in like broader evangelical circles, if you were talking to somebody and you did the whole like, oh, well, when's the last time you shared the gospel with them thing, they would feel bad and they would feel ashamed, but they wouldn't call you out on it. They wouldn't say that like, that's not a reasonable or an appropriate thing to do, or that's cruel, or, you know, they would just be like, oh yeah, you know, whatever. But if you did the same thing to somebody about going to church who wasn't going to church regularly, like,
oh yeah,
like it's almost like it's okay to shame as long as it's not God's law.
Wow. When you say it that way, David, it feels so icky. But no, I mean, hard to verify, but yeah, I do. We can all think of examples where that's happened. And I wonder what it's going to take to kind of reverse that. Good thing that's not for you or I to decide or to figure out. It's for people like Ben, who's going to be a pastor. Good luck with it, Ben, on figuring out how to do that, how to properly shame people. When he comes on next, he can tell us how to properly shame and how to avoid.
I think David, what you do is you spell things out phonetically in Slack.
Okay. Yeah. Heraclitus. Pericles. So yeah, you know, this is a good discussion, but we're going to have to call it a day here, maybe, because we're on the clock here, and I have to rush off to do something. So, but good call on possibly talking about in the future how to persuade, how people persuade people and the things you can do wrong with it. And this is one of those ways.
That seems like a very flogging-y topic. And this exact thing is used with things like how often you read the Bible, how long you read the Bible for, how often you pray.
Oh, yeah.
And there are like things that the Bible does have to say about how often you should do that. But again, like the length of time that you spend in prayer or reading scripture is something that in my church I was shamed for. Or that actually that was the side that I could be a Pharisee on. That was the side where I could feel better than everyone because like it's easy for me to stick my nose in a book for a long time.
Oh, right. Yeah. Anyway. Well, great talk. Thank you for your time, David. We thank you listeners for your time. And we'll see you all next week. So take it easy out there.
Hasta.
Hasta luego.
I don't know. I was going to be funny and then I realized how cliche that is.
We're trying to be more funny. We're trying to be more funny. Hasta Heraclitus, everyone. All right.
Won't someone save me from this podcast? Is it over or just dragging along? Will these two guys talk? Started off so tongue in cheek. Now it seems it's almost over. So I'll just have